Sweet in the morning, oh Lord, it's sweet in the morning.
Hello, you're listening to Community Public Radio. My name is Vernon White, and this is Wake Up Call. And I want to welcome you to this edition of Wake Up Call. Today on Wake Up Call, we have a few topics we're going to cover. We'll hear from Al Franken requesting that Attorney General Jefferson Beauregard Sessions returns to the Senate due to his failure to tell the truth in a previous encounter. Next, Attorney General Beauregard gets questioned by Senators Ted Lieu and Hakeem Jeffries from New York on President Trump, Russia, and Trump Jr. Then we move to St. Ugar of the Young Turks on Trump's appointment of Alex Bazar as the Health and Human Services Secretary. That'll be followed by Chamonix Perez of RT, who asks the question, what happened to Trump's trade war with China? Before we go to break, we'll listen to a portion of a conversation with Chris Hedges and Abby Martin as they talk about the rise of Christian fundamentalism. Once again, this is Community Public Radio. My name is Bernard White, and this is Wake Up Call. Stay tuned. Sweet in the morning. Tell the truth.
Madam President, new developments in the ongoing investigation into Russian interference in the election have once again raised concerns about the accuracy of statements made by Attorney General Jeff Sessions during his appearance before the Senate. In light of the Attorney General's failure to tell the truth about not just his own interactions with Russian operatives, but also the extent to which he knew about Russian contacts by other members of the Trump campaign team, I call upon Attorney General Sessions to return to the Senate Judiciary Committee and provide us with a complete and accurate accounting of the facts. Madam President, there is no question that Russia, a hostile foreign power, meddled in our election. Russia carried out this attack in order to undermine confidence in American democracy, to damage Hillary Clinton's campaign for president, and to help Donald Trump. Our intelligence agencies have confirmed this to be true, but in order to keep our country safe and prevent an attack like this from happening again, the American people need to understand what happened, including whether members of the Trump campaign either participated in the Russian operation or turned a blind eye to it. We need to get to the bottom of this, and to do that, we need to know the truth. But, Madam President, regrettably, Attorney General Sessions, our nation's chief law enforcement officer, seems to have a real problem telling the truth about both his own actions with Russians and those of the larger Trump campaign team. At his confirmation hearing in January, when I referenced a breaking report from CNN that there had been a, quote, continuing exchange of information during the campaign between Trump's surrogates and intermediaries for the Russian government, unquote, I asked him, quote, if there is any evidence that anyone affiliated with the Trump campaign communicated with the Russian government in the course of this campaign, what will you do? This was a simple, straightforward question. What will you do? The implication was, would you recuse yourself? But rather than answer that question, then Senator Sessions said, quote, I did not have communications with the Russians, end quote. That, of course, was not true. It was later revealed that Attorney General Sessions had met with the Russian ambassador at least three times during the campaign. Only after two of those meetings were uncovered and disclosed, 7 weeks later, did Attorney General Sessions announce his recusal from the Russian investigation. But after he was confronted with the truth, the Attorney General began to subtly change his story. His first answer, under oath, before the Judiciary Committee in January, was that he, quote, did not have communications with the Russians, unquote, period. But after his meetings with the Russian ambassador were exposed, Attorney General Sessions began to qualify his explanations. In a statement issued on March 2nd, the day after his Russian contacts were revealed, he said, quote, I never met with any Russian officials to discuss issues of the campaign. But in July, the Washington Post published a report suggesting that the Attorney General did discuss campaign issues with the Russian ambassador. According to the report, American intelligence agencies intercepted communications between the Russian ambassador and the Kremlin, in which the ambassador described his conversations with then Senator Sessions. The two men reportedly talked about substantive policy matters, including campaign-related issues. In response to this report, the Justice Department issued a statement stating that Attorney General Sessions stood by his testimony and again claimed that the Attorney General did not discuss, quote, interference with any campaign or election. Madam President, each and every time that new information comes to light about the Attorney General's contacts with the Russians, he has responded not by coming clean and admitting that his initial testimony was inaccurate, but by shifting his story and moving the goalposts. Madam President, the truth has a nasty habit of catching up with Attorney General Sessions. Recently, unsealed court documents revealed that in early October, former Trump campaign foreign policy advisor George Papadopoulos, pled guilty to lying to the FBI about his communications with Russian operatives during the campaign. The unsealed documents also revealed that Mr. Papadopoulos didn't just meet with Russian operatives during the campaign, he did so with the express goal of facilitating meetings between the Russian government and other Trump campaign officials, including the candidate himself, Donald Trump. According to the court documents, Mr. Papadopoulos made no secret of his Russian contacts. He described his Russian meetings in emails to senior campaign officials. And according to Mr. Papadopoulos, he discussed his Russian contacts with then Senator Sessions directly. On March 31, 2016, Mr. Papadopoulos attended a meeting of the Trump campaign's National Security Advisory Committee, a group led by Attorney General Sessions, who chaired the committee and advised the candidate on foreign policy and national security matters. The court documents reveal that after Mr. Papadopoulos introduced himself to the group, he, quote, stated in sum and substance that he had connections that could help arrange a meeting between then-candidate Trump and President Putin. Mr. Papadopoulos made that speech while seated two seats to the left of Attorney General Sessions. We know that for a fact because then-candidate Trump posted a photo of the meeting on Instagram. There is then-Senator Sessions. There is George Papadopoulos, and there is then-candidate Donald Trump. After the court documents were unsealed, after the court documents were unsealed, reports about what happened at the March 31st meeting began to emerge. Reportedly, Mr. Papadopoulos spoke about facilitating a meeting between the candidate and the president for a few minutes. Then candidate Trump reportedly, quote, listened with interest and asked questions of Mr. Papadopoulos. But according to an advisor present at the meeting, then Senator Sessions reacted negatively to Mr. Papadopoulos's idea and reportedly, quote, shut Papadopoulos down. Attorney General Sessions is reported to have said, quote, we're not going to do it. And I prefer that nobody speak about this again. If those reports are accurate, they would signal that then Senator Sessions reacted quite strongly to the suggestion that then candidate Trump should meet with President Putin. Such a strong reaction suggests that Attorney General Sessions would have remembered a conversation like that. Mr. Papadopoulos wasn't the only member of the campaign to tell Attorney General Sessions about his Russian contacts. Earlier this month, Carter Page, yet another former Trump campaign foreign policy advisor who is under scrutiny for his Russian contacts, testified to the House Intelligence Committee that he told then Senator Sessions about a trip to Russia that Page was going to take in July of 2016, where he met with Russian officials and state-owned businesses. Nonetheless, Madam President, time and time again, Attorney General Sessions has claimed under oath that he was unaware of any communications between Russians and members of the Trump campaign. During his confirmation hearing in January, when I mentioned reports that there was a, quote, continuing exchange of information during the campaign between Trump surrogates and intermediaries for the Russian government, the Attorney General said that he was, quote, not aware of any of those activities. My good friend Pat Leahy asked him in writing whether he, quote, had, quote, been in contact with anyone connected to any part of the Russian government about the 2016 election. The Attorney General answered simply, no. In June, Attorney General Sessions appeared before the Senate Intelligence Committee. In his opening statement, he said, quote, I have never met with or had any conversations with any Russians or any foreign officials concerning any type of interference with any campaign or election in the United States. Further, I have no knowledge of any such conversations by anyone connected to the Trump campaign. Senator Risch asked him, quote, did you hear even a whisper or a suggestion or anyone making reference within that campaign that somehow the Russians were involved in that campaign? Attorney General Sessions replied, quote, I did not. Senator Joe Manchin asked him, quote, are there any other meetings between Russian government officials and any other Trump campaign associates that have not been previously disclosed that you know of? Attorney General Sessions said that he did not recall any such meetings. Senator Kamala Harris asked him, quote, are you aware of any communications with other Trump campaign officials and associates that they had with Russian officials or any Russian nationals? Attorney General Sessions replied, quote, I don't recall that. Just last month, during the Attorney General's most recent appearance before the Judiciary Committee, Senator Lindsey Graham asked him, quote, did anybody in the campaign, did you ever overhear a conversation between you and anybody on the campaign who talked about meeting with the Russians? This time, Attorney General Sessions replied quite carefully. He said, quote, I have not seen anything that would indicate collusion with Russians to impact the campaign. But when I asked him to clarify his shifting explanations for his own interactions with the Russian ambassador. Attorney General Sessions said that when he first heard about reports of a, quote, continuing exchange of information between Russians and the Trump campaign, that he was, quote, taken aback by this dramatic statement that I'd never heard before and knew nothing about. He said that, quote, a continuing exchange of information between Trump's surrogates and intermediaries for the Russian government did not happen, at least not to my knowledge, and not with me. Describing his January testimony, he said, quote, and I said, I'm not aware of those activities, and I wasn't, and am not, and don't believe they occurred. Madam President, setting aside the convenient amnesia that Attorney General Sessions seems to experience when asked about his own interactions with Russians or those that he witnessed, I find it disturbing that he went so far as to claim, as recently as October of this year, that he didn't believe that any meetings between Trump associates and Russians ever occurred. Just think about the campaign, the Trump campaign members we know to have met with Russians from publicly available information. Carter Page, former campaign advisor. Paul Manafort, former campaign manager and chief strategist. Michael Flynn, the disgraced former national security advisor, who in 2015 spoke at a party honoring Russia's state-owned television network where he sat next to Vladimir Putin. Jared Kushner, White House advisor and son-in-law. And Donald Trump Jr., the president's son. Each and every one of these former members of the Trump campaign have had unusual contacts with the Russians. Nonetheless, just last month, the Attorney General said, and I quote, I'm not aware of those activities, and I wasn't and am not, and don't believe they occurred, unquote. You know, I wanted to say to Attorney General Sessions, listen, I understand that you're recused from the Russia investigation, but do you think that means you're not allowed to watch the news or read a newspaper? My God, what is going on here? Madam President, it is clear that Attorney General Sessions has an ongoing difficulty remembering his own interactions with Russians and the extent to which he knew about Russian contacts with other members of the Trump campaign. And as the record demonstrates, Attorney General Sessions has misrepresented the truth about those contacts to members of this body time and time again. The interference by a hostile power in our nation's elections represents an attack on democracy itself. And the inability of our nation's top law enforcement official to speak with a clear and consistent voice about what he knows of the Russian operation is disturbing. Tomorrow morning, the Attorney General will appear before the House Judiciary Committee, where I am confident that he will once again face questions about this issue. It is my hope that this time, Attorney General Sessions will answer those questions honestly. But in light of his misrepresentations to members of this body, Attorney General Sessions has an obligation to return to the Senate and explain himself. Getting to the bottom of Russia's interference in the 2016 election is a matter of national security. And Attorney General Sessions owes the American people an explanation about what he knows. He needs to return to the Senate Judiciary Committee to set the record straight. Thank you, Madam President.
Everyone, in the night, beware disguises. In the dark, they hide from the truth. In the end, they lie to you. One day the skeletons are gonna come out. One day the elephant in the room will make a sound. Watch out for lions and tigers and bears. He's about to hit the fan.
Last year, how many interactions did you have with Russian government official Sergei Kislyak? I just need a number. Is it three?
Well, of all foreign officials or just?
Russian government official, Ambassador Sergei Kislyak, last year, how many interactions did you have with him?
I spoke at the Republican convention. I came off the platform and the people were there and we chatted a moment, had an encounter. Couple of months later, I believe in September, he asked for a meeting, and I provided that. I met with approximately 25 ambassadors last year, so, and I had that same day as, well, excuse me.
Thank you,
ahead.
Mr. Sessions. Thank you. Well, as Attorney General, you have a security clearance, correct?
Yes.
And to get that security clearance, you submitted a security clearance application, also known as an SF-86 form, correct?
That's correct.
I submitted such a form when I served on active duty in the U.S. Air Force. And the form requires you to certify under penalty of perjury that the information submitted was true, complete, and correct to the best of your knowledge. You certified your security clearance form, correct?
That is correct.
I'm going to, on the video screen, show you a question from that form, and it says, have you or any of your immediate family in the past 7 years had any contact with a foreign government, its establishment, such as embassy, consulate agency, military service, intelligence, or security service, et cetera, or its representatives, whether inside or outside the U.S.? The answer that you gave was no. What you just told us under oath was exactly the opposite. So I'm going to ask you, Mr. Sessions, were you lying then when you filled out the form, or are you lying now?
What I was told by my executive assistant when we did this form earlier and then again when I was nominated for Attorney General, that the FBI authority says members of Congress and effectively government officials meeting people on an official basis, you were not required to list all these contacts.
Nothing in that question says you get to answer any differently because you're a U.S. senator rather than, say, a young police officer. Isn't that right?
Well,
nothing in that question authorizes you to answer any differently. Isn't that right?
I would say that nobody at the FBI or any other place, to my knowledge, said you left that blank. Surely you've met with some foreign officials in the last 7 years. I've not had any private business dealings or any things of that nature. My contacts would be in the normal course of
senatorial business. Let me ask you one of your interactions.
So I thought that was a reasonable answer.
You said under oath today that you had a meeting with Ambassador Kislyak of under an hour. That's pretty long. Was it more than 50 minutes?
I doubt it was 50 minutes, but
45?
It may have been. 45, 50 minutes.
All right. Did you discuss campaign?
Ambassador,
did you discuss campaign-related items such as Ukraine with an ambassador?
Well, that's not campaign-related.
All right. I'm going to ask you two simple
yes,
questions.
Yes, we did talk about Ukraine. We actually had an argument about the Ukraine because the day before, the Ukrainian ambassador was in my office making his case against Russia, and I raised those issues with Mr. Kislyak, and he was, as I referred to it, I think, the classic, we did nothing wrong.
I'm glad you're
Ukraine
very animated.
Did everything wrong. That was his
let me question. Ask you two simple questions, because in a sense you've already answered it. You did have communications with the Russians last year, isn't that right?
Repeat that.
You did have communications with the Russians last year, isn't that right? Just yes or no.
I had a meeting with the Russian ambassador, yes.
Great. That's exactly the opposite answer you gave under oath to U.S. Senate. So again, either you're lying to U.S. Senate or you're lying to U.S. House of Representatives.
Well,
The time of the gentleman has expired. The witness can answer any further if he chooses to.
I won't repeat it, Mr. Chairman, but I hope the congressman knows, and I hope all of you know, that my answer to that question, I did not meet with the Russians, was explicitly responding to the shocking suggestion that I, as a surrogate, was meeting on a continuing basis with Russian officials, and the implication was to impact the campaign in some sort of nefarious way. And all I did was meet in my office with the ambassador, which we didn't discuss anything like that. So I just want to say I appreciate the congressman's right. I guess he can say it's free speech. He can't be sued here. So I just... my response, and I'm sorry that that's my response.
Mr. Sessions, I have a copy of the transcript of your testimony before the Senate Judiciary Committee in October. You stated under oath, I don't recall, in some form or fashion, 29 times. Is that correct?
I have no idea.
I have a copy of the transcript of your testimony before the Senate Intelligence Committee in June. You stated under oath, I don't recall, in some form or fashion, approximately 36 times. Is that correct?
I don't know.
In your testimony today, you have stated, I don't recall, at least 20 times. Is that fair to say?
I have no idea.
Now, on October 4th, 2016, during a TV interview with Lou Dobbs, you criticized Hillary Clinton for telling FBI investigators, I can't remember, approximately 35 times. You also stated during that Lou Dobbs interview that the intentional failure to remember can constitute perjury. Mr. Attorney General, do you still believe that the intentional failure to remember can constitute a criminal act?
If it's an act to deceive, yes.
Okay. Now, you testified in January that you had no contact with Russian operatives during the Trump campaign. Earlier today, you testified that your story has, quote, never changed. Is that correct? That was your testimony earlier today, that your story has never changed, correct?
I believe that's fair to say.
Okay.
We've added things that I did not recall at the time.
Right.
So statement at the time was my best recollection of the circumstances. And as things are brought up.
Claiming my time, I understand.
All right.
Sir, you now acknowledge meeting with Ambassador Kislyak during the Republican National Convention, correct?
I remember I made a speech. He came up to me afterwards. I was standing in front of the speaker program and did chat with him.
Okay, thank you. And you also
had an encounter, not a meeting. It was just an encounter at that time.
Okay, and you also met with the ambassador in September of 2016 in your office, as you've acknowledged, correct?
He asked for an appointment. I had two senior staffers, both full colonels in the United States Army, retired in the meeting with
me. I'm sorry. You testified in June before the Senate Intelligence Committee that you had not heard even a whisper about possible Russian involvement in the Trump campaign. Yet we understand that you attended this March 31st meeting where George Papadopoulos talked about potential communications with Russian operatives. But also, according to your third quarter 2016 FEC filing, you hosted a Trump campaign dinner meeting on June 30th, 2016 at the Capitol Hill Club. Is that right?
That's correct, I believe.
And your Senate reelection campaign paid for that meeting. Is that right?
I think that may be so.
Okay. And Carter Page and George Papadopoulos both attended that June 30th meeting, correct?
That has been reported.
And at that meeting, Carter Page told you that that he was going to Moscow in a few days. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
He said it was a brief meeting as he was walking out the door. I don't recall that conversation, but I'm not able to dispute it.
Understood. Reclaiming my time, I've got limited time available.
That is not, establish some sort of improper contact?
I think you understand.
Russians?
I think you understand.
He's not Russian either. You
understand, sir. I get to ask the questions. You provide the answers in this capacity. You're no longer in the United States Senate. You voted in 1999 to remove Bill Clinton from office on charges of perjury, correct?
That is correct.
Well,
there were other charges. I voted
simple
for
question.
Impeachment, yes.
Yes, understand. To remove him, actually, impeachment's in the House. In connection with that vote to remove President Clinton from office, you gave this speech on the Senate floor on February 29th, 1999. And in it, you acknowledged that while serving as U.S. attorney, you once prosecuted a young police officer who lied in a deposition. And in that speech, you decided to prosecute that young police officer even though he corrected his testimony. Now, you testified under oath before the Senate Judiciary Committee in January. You subsequently corrected that testimony in a March 6 written submission and have been forced repeatedly to come back to the Senate and now the House to clarify. When explaining your vote on the Senate floor to remove Bill Clinton from office, you stated that you refuse to hold a president accountable to a different standard than the young police officer who you prosecuted. Let me be clear. The Attorney General of the United States of America should not be held to a different standard than the young police officer whose life you ruined by prosecuting him for perjury. I yield back.
The gentleman may respond if he chooses to.
Mr. Jeffries, nobody, not you or anyone else, should be prosecuted, not me, or accused of perjury for answering the question the way I did in this hearing. I've always tried to answer the questions fairly and accurately. But to ask, did you ever do something, do you ever meet with Russians and deal with the campaign? You're saying Mr. Carter Page, who left that meeting, according to the press reports, and I guess his deposition or interview has been reported as saying, I'm going to Russia. I made no response to him, didn't acknowledge it. And you're accusing me of lying about that? I say that's not fair, Mr. Jeffries. I would say that's not fair, colleagues. That's not on any indication that I in any way participated in anything wrong. And the same with Mr. Papadopoulos. He talked about, it's reported in the paper, that he said something about going to Russia and dealing with the Russians. And I pushed back and said you shouldn't do it. So I don't think I'm is right to accuse me in any wrongdoing with regard to influencing this campaign improperly.
For no reason, they point fingers by the hand that feeds them. Help alone, but they know now what they do. Swear to God, they know better than you. Under the skeletons.
Gentlemen, fellow Americans, lady Americans, this is James Brown. I want to talk to you about one of our most deadly killers in the country today. I had a dream the other night, and I was sitting in my living room, just dozed off to sleep, so I started dreaming. I dreamed I walked in a place and saw a real strange, weird object standing up talking to the people, and I found out it was heroin, that deadly drug that go in your vein. He said, I came to this country without a passport. Ever since then, I've been hunted and sought. My little white grains are nothing but waste, soft and deadly and bitter to taste. But I'm a world of power, and all know it's true. Use me once, and you'll know it too. I can make a mere schoolboy forget his books. I can make a world-famous beauty neglect her looks. I can make a good man forsake his wife, send a greedy man to prison for the rest of his life. I can make a man forsake his country and flag, make a girl sell her body for a $5 bag. Some think my adventure's a joy and a thriller, but I'll put a gun in your hand and make you a killer. In cellophane bags, I found my way to heads of state, to children at play. I financed in China, ran in Japan. I'm respected in Turkey, and I'm legal in Siam. I take my addicts and make them steal, borrow, beg. Then they search for a vein in the arm or the leg. So be you Italian, Jewish, black or mix, I can make the most world of men forget their sex. So now my man, you must, you know, do your best to keep up your habit until your arrest. Now the police have taken you from under my wing. Do you think they dare defy me, I who am king? Now you must lie in that county jail, where I can't get to you by visit or mail. So squirm with discomfort, wiggle and cough. 6 days of madness, and you might throw me off. Curse me in name, defy me in speech, but you'd pick me up right now if I were in your reach. All through your center, you become resolved to your fate. Fear not, young man or woman, I'll be waiting at the gate. And don't be afraid, don't run, I'll not chase. Sure, my name is Heroin, and you'll be back for a taste. Behold, you're hooked. Your foot is in the stirrup. And make haste, mount the steed, and ride him well. For the white horse of Heroin will ride you to hell. To hell will ride you to hell until you are dead. Dead, brother. Dead. This is a revolution of mind. Get your mind together and get away from drugs.
Donald Trump's Health and Human Services Secretary stepped down, Tom Price, for corruption. He kept using private jets on your dime. This is something that Tom Price had complained about before he had an opportunity to do it, and he did it all day, all night. That's why he stepped down. Hypocrisy and corruption through the roof, so that's okay. Trump's going to announce a new HHS secretary. Let's find out who it is. He says, happy to announce I am nominating Alex Azar to be the next HHS secretary. He will be a star for better health care and lower drug prices. Really? Well, that sounds positive, right? I mean, Trump promised lower drug prices on the campaign trail. He said he would fight the drug makers and make sure that the government could negotiate with them. It hasn't happened yet. Maybe Azar is activist. Maybe he has held the drug companies accountable before, and that's why he's a good pick. It could be. I mean, remember, as HuffPost points out, in promising to combat high drug prices, Trump has been critical of drug companies, saying that they are, quote, getting away with murder, and threatening, quote, some very major lawsuits against people and against companies that are hurting our people. So Trump is ready to go after those drug companies that are hurting our people, okay? They're getting away with murder. So Azar has obviously held those guys accountable. Let's find out what Azar did for a living. Azar, until January, was an executive at drug maker Eli Lilly. What? Wait, I thought he was going to hold them accountable. He worked as a president at Eli Lilly. That doesn't sound like he's holding them accountable. Okay, well, let's find out specifically what he did, because maybe he was the internal cop. Right? You said, okay, lower the drug prices. No, it turns out he led Lilly public affairs and lobbying efforts. Oh, great, he was a lobbyist for the drug makers. What was that about the swamp? You're a Trump supporter and you thought he was going to drain the swamp? He's laughing at you. Lower the drug prices. I'm going to put in the guy who lobbied to make them higher, you idiots. Trump is as corrupt as it gets, and he puts like guys like Azar in for that, not despite the fact that they worked for drug makers and lobbied for them, but because of that. So in 2009, under Azar, the company paid $1.415 billion to settle criminal charges regarding his promotion of Zyprexa for off-label uses. Oh, good. And borderline criminal activity. Nobody ever goes to jail if they're rich anymore. You go to jail if you stole 10 bucks from somebody, but they steal $1.4 billion. They just pay a fine. Effective January 1st, 2012, Azar became president of Lilly USA LLC, the largest division of Eli Lilly and Company, and was responsible for the company's entire operations in the United States. Prices for drugs rose substantially when Azar led the business. The joke is on you. Trump is not going to put people that are going to lower drug prices. He has done absolutely nothing about it. Hey, they just did a whole healthcare proposal. In the proposal could have been a provision that said the United States government can now negotiate drug prices with the drug companies for Medicare. Was that in the proposal? Nope, not in the proposal. Now all of a sudden the guy who's going to lead HHS is a guy who was a lobbyist and president for the guys who increased drug prices. So what has Azar said? Well, Azar said in the past that insurers and pharmaceutical companies should work together to reduce drug prices without government intervention. So while he's president, the drug prices skyrocket at his drug company. Then as a joke, he turns around and goes, well, if the government doesn't interfere, maybe we'll voluntarily lower them. Well, you had all the opportunity in the world to voluntarily lower them when you were the president of the company. And you didn't lower them, you increased them. So you know what that makes you? A liar. And the idea that the companies, out of the goodness of their heart, will ignore the law about maximizing profit, well, instead, just because they're such good people, lower drug prices. If you believe that, no wonder you voted for Trump, because you are a blithering idiot. Okay, if he becomes HHS Secretary, Azar will take over the administration of the Affordable Care Act, which he has criticized as fundamentally broken, and like most Republicans, wants to repeal. Great. As the Health and Human Services Secretary, he will get to destroy Health and Human Services in America. This is a familiar pattern for Trump's appointments. Now, unfortunately, the law gives the HHS secretary enormous discretion over how to administer the program. This includes, for example, rewriting the rules over exactly what qualifies as essential benefits that all insurers must cover, and approving requests by states to waive some of the law's regulations on how Medicaid works. In other words, deregulate the industry. Let's make more money. Oh, the thing about having to cover pre-existing conditions, it's a good thing I've got a lot of latitude here. I'm not sure you have to follow that anymore. And this is how we destroy the chances of people getting covered. Universal coverage, not even remotely possible. They're going to shred whatever is left of the Affordable Care Act. Azar will work for the George W. Bush administration, went and made bank at Eli Lilly, made a ton of money lobbying for them and then running a huge portion of their business. Then he goes back into government and he will not lower drug prices. I absolutely, positively guarantee it. He will increase drug prices. He will help his former employees who gave him millions of dollars to increase drug prices more. And here's another guarantee. Once he leaves the Trump administration, guess where Azar is going to go back to? To another drug maker and make millions of dollars more and laugh all the way to the bank, thinking, idiot Trump voters, you let us rob you blind. Just like Trump University, just like everything Trump has ever run, they warned you and you didn't listen. Thank you very much for letting us rob you. That's the plan, and that's what they're doing right now, right in front of your eyes.
It's the Real News Network. I'm Sharmini Peeris coming to you from Baltimore. President Trump is returning from a 12-day trip to Asia. One big highlight that he will be boasting about will be the $250 billion in investment deals he has signed with China. This includes an $83 billion deal for China to invest in fracking in West Virginia over the next 20 years. Trump also tried to convince President Xi Jinping to increase sanctions and pressure on North Korea to abandon its nuclear weapons ambitions. Here's a clip from what Trump said in reference to the U.S. trade deficit with China.
I don't blame China. Who can blame a country for being able to take advantage of another country for the benefit of its citizens? I give China great credit.
Joining us to analyze Trump's visit to China is Jeffrey Wasserstrom. Jeffrey is Chancellor's Professor of History at UC Irvine. Among his many books, he has co-authored China in the 21st Century, What Everyone Needs to Know, which was first published in 2010. A third edition will come out this spring, which he has co-authored with Maura Elizabeth Cunningham. Jeffrey, good to have you back on The Real News.
It's good to be back on the show.
So, Jeffrey, let's begin with how Trump's emphasis on America First trade deals were received in China.
Well, I think it's seen as something that both sides can present as a positive thing. It's probably just moving forward on things that were already in the works, but it's something that they can talk about as something that is, as both leaders like to present this as a win-win situation, as the two groups working together. It certainly must have been music to Xi Jinping's ears to hear Trump go from presenting the trade imbalance as something that was due to Chinese misbehavior to presenting it as something that was due to failings by his own predecessors. So that was the sort of moment in the economic issues where people were surprised that he would do such a kind of about face from the rhetoric that he had on the campaign trail. Presidents, once they take office, always do modify the criticism they have of China when they're actually dealing with a Chinese leader. But this was a really dramatic shift.
Now, it is no doubt that President Trump will be highlighting the Chinese investment deals of $250 billion. Most of this in U.S. energy sector, aside from the fact that Chinese investments in the U.S. is nothing new, this particular deal of, I believe it was $83 billion that's going to be invested in West Virginia in the coal sector, and none of us knows enough detail right now to go into it, but how does this fit into China's overall objectives, because they are now being seen as a champion of the environmental movement with innovation and trying to get their own emissions under control. And in the world stage, they're being seen as good guys, but this seems to be a step back from that.
Well, I think Xi Jinping is likely to see that how China will be judged and what sort of matters most is what's going on inside the country. I think the Chinese Communist Party is very worried about popular discontent with polluted skies and polluted water. And I think the focus of whatever environmental moves there will be largely trying to get a handle on that, which is, it's really, in some cases, quite horrific proportions. and there'll be a different standard used for things that are abroad. And we should keep our eye also on the way in which the big infrastructure projects outside of China's borders related to the Belt and Road Initiative that has recently been included and enshrined in China's constitution and is clearly one of Xi Jinping's hallmark enterprises. If there too, there are things being done that are that have a carbon footprint that goes against the vision of China as championing green energy in other realms.
Right. And tell us about this initiative that you had just talked about, the Belt and Road Initiative. This initiative was, as you say, launched 4 years ago. And what are its objectives? And this is something that the U.S. doesn't seem to be as engaged in. And why?
Yeah, well, it's still hard to know what it is. It's quite nebulous in some ways, though it clearly is starting to. It's being used as a catch-all for all kinds of efforts by Beijing to establish connections with other parts of the world. And it's a very flexible. Some of it's linked to the historic Silk Road. It's important to know that the historic Silk Road or Silk Roads, because there wasn't just a single path, tended to be ones in which things flowed in both directions and things influenced China by coming in on the Silk Road as well as coming out from China to other places. This Belt and Road Initiative is more of a one-way push, with China getting involved in development programs, but also establishing a situation in which more and more of its neighbors and then countries further away are entwined with China in ways that make them indebted to some extent economically and likely to be also more willing to accept or support China's diplomatic efforts in the international arena. So it is an effort of China to project its influence in other places. Beijing makes a big deal of the fact that it's not trying, as traditional empires did, to make other countries directly subordinate to it. And it also claims to be different from the U.S. when it projected its influence, when the United States tried to bring other countries more toward seeing the world and embracing political systems more like our own. They're saying that the idea is just to let other countries go their own way, but benefit from Chinese investment. So right. I think, but there's a subtle way in which, or not so subtle way in some cases, where there could be other forms of power that go along with these kinds of economic and infrastructure things. China seems quite clearly to want to have some kinds of places abroad where they could be used potentially for strategic reasons as well as purely economic ones.
Jeffrey, if you saw candidate Trump lashing out at China, particularly the language around the trade deficit and how it was so unfair and so on, yet when President Xi Jinping came to Mar-a-Lago or this particular trip now to Beijing, President Trump's maiden trip to Beijing, there's a different kind of juxtaposition, and there is certainly lots of symbolism and niceties being exchanged, and some of that harsh terminology that Trump used to describe our relations with China has all subsided. Now, do you think that this is the way forward, and do you feel that these animosities still exist and this is a cover-up, or that this is how you think will be the future of relations with China?
Well, I think we should distinguish between things that are unusual and things that are part of kind of familiar patterns. There is a pattern in the U.S. for people campaigning for the presidency to talk tougher on China than they do once in the presidency, when they actually try to work things out with their counterpart in Beijing. So in some ways, Trump is conforming to that kind of pattern. In other ways, though, he's going further in conforming and actually giving in, sometimes without, it seems, any kind of pushback to things that the Chinese side in this would like. for example, the press conference. Press conferences are usually very limited affairs during these kinds of things, but there is at least, there's an effort by the American side to push for at least some questions to be asked by the press. The Chinese Communist Party that doesn't like the unexpected would prefer there to be no questions from the press. In this case, there were no questions from the press, and that was described by Trump's side as simply going along with what the host wanted, but in the past, there had always been at least some kind of pushback. Similarly, there's generally been at least some pressure put from the American side on issues related to prisoners of conscience and forms of repression within the PRC. And it seems, at least at this point, that Trump and his team didn't really put any pressure on those kinds of things. The one way in which he did get involved that we know of was in trying to secure the release of three basketball players, young men who were potentially at the mercy of a judicial system that has limited ability, whether they were guilty or not, would have had limited ability for a fair and open trial. But as far as we know, he didn't say anything about the people roughly the same age, young prisoners of conscience about the same age in Hong Kong, that are potentially facing similar kinds of problems. And we don't know if he said anything about the still murky situation of Liu Xiaobo, the Nobel Peace Prize winner who died in prison. His wife, who has not been seen or has been only seen in very questionable kinds of situations since the summer. These are all things that the American side might not have gotten major concessions on, but that past administrations would have probably made some kinds of efforts on. So in many ways, Trump behaved very much the way Xi Jinping would have hoped he would behave, keeping the focus on just two issues, really, North Korea and trade, and not bringing up these other things that the Chinese side has often seen as kind of pesky things that you have to deal with when there is an American president visiting the country.
Speaking of things that they didn't want to talk about, it's obviously the South China Sea. Now, prior to President Trump arriving in China, there was all this posturing in terms of the U.S. presence in the South China Sea and the potential access they could easily have so close to China by way of the U.S. military presence in the region. Now, all of that was not discussed, as far as we know. And if they were, it was sort of quite sidelined and wasn't the major thrust of the visit. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think similarly, there was a decision to really focus on these two issues, North Korea and trade. And so things that didn't fit in with that framework got shuffled to the bottom of the deck. I mean, it was also a relatively incoherent trip across Asia, is what some of the commentators have been saying, that the focus shifted depending on where Trump was. One of the continuities was his expressions of esteem for figures who are widely regarded as strongmen figures exerting a kind of authoritarian control over the population. So this was another thing that basically didn't get attention while he was in Beijing, which was probably something that Beijing would prefer. There was then some discussion of South China Sea when he moved to Southeast Asia.
All right. Now, the one big issue that I saw being talked about in a lot of the financial press is that this $250 billion in trade deals that were signed, a lot of them had a sense of unease that these are just agreements that they won't somehow materialize in concrete form. Is there a history of that with China?
Yeah, there's a history of there being kind of a disconnect between some of the things promised and some of the things that end up emerging. And they are also, some of them are kind of high profile, things for show. I think The bigger disconnect, though, is actually that from Xi Jinping's side, that when he went down to the APEC summit, he gave a speech, something like what he gave at Davos, where he talked about his commitment to globalization and to opening China in various ways to the world, at the same time that the overall trend under Xi has been to close China off more. And it's just a very strange kind of situation now to figure out. He partly seems to be getting a pass on this simply because he's not talking in explicitly economic nationalist terms at a time when Trump and many other world leaders are talking in explicitly economic nationalist terms, that there's a kind of willingness to look the other way at a lot of the economic nationalist moves that are being made, including the continuing clamping down on the internet and the access of international businesses to China via the internet. These are things that go against the grain of the discussion of China as a leader in globalization, but for some reason it gets sort of drowned out by the happy talk at these international meetings by Xi, and to some extent also the happy talk about these kinds of trade agreements. I think a bigger picture is, if we look overall at how things are going with the Chinese economy and Chinese politics alike, this is not a period of increasing openness to the world, and certainly not when it comes to the flow of ideas.
All right. I've been speaking with Jeffrey Wasserstrom. He is the co-author of China in the 21st Century, What Everyone Needs to Know. I thank you so much for joining us today, Jeffrey.
It's been a pleasure.
And thank you for joining us here on the Real News Network.
This is Community Public Radio, and my name is Bernard White. Before we go to our conversation with Abby Martin and Chris Hedges, President Donald Trump repeated his assertion over the weekend that Moscow did not meddle in the 2016 presidential election, in direct conflict with conclusions drawn by the U.S. intelligence community. But that official judgment runs counter to a group of former intel analysts who say that the so-called Russian hack of the Democratic National Convention's emails was actually an inside job. RT America's Ashley Banks speaks to former CIA analyst Ray McGovern and NSA whistleblower Bill Biney, two people involved in that analysis.
We begin today at the APEC International Summit in Vietnam, where President Trump met briefly with Russian President Vladimir Putin over the weekend. Putin assured Trump that Russia did not interfere with the 2016 election. Trump responded by saying he believes that Putin meant it, but shortly thereafter, Trump changed his comments to, quote, "I'm with our agencies. I believe in our intelligence agencies," referring to the accusations made by U.S. intelligence agencies that Russia interfered with the U.S. election. To discuss this further, we are now joined by former CIA analyst Ray McGovern and NSA veteran and whistleblower Bill Binney. Thank you, gentlemen, for joining me. I'm going to start with you, Ray. In your recent essay, Mocking Trump Doesn't Prove Russia's Guilty, you described how the U.S. political establishment and media was outraged that President Trump would actually believe Putin over his own intelligence agencies. But if our own agencies have not produced concrete evidence of Russian hacking, Ray, why should Trump believe them?
Well, it was one of those ha 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 moments. How could you believe Trump? How could you believe Putin? How could you believe that Trump believed Putin? Headline said this was unconscionable that you could believe either of them on anything. I'd like to finish your little quote from what Trump said later. He didn't say he has trust in the U.S. intelligence agencies. He finished that clause by saying, as presently constituted. That's a big difference. What he did was accuse the former leaders of our intelligence agencies, Brennan and others, including Comey, as being political hacks. So that's the hack story, folks. What Trump called these people were political hacks, and he knows that because of my colleague Bill Binney. I had a chance to brief the director of the Central Intelligence Agency and tell him about the forensic
I repeat, forensic evidence, the investigations that for some reason FBI Director Comey forgot to do or didn't want to do of the DNC computers, which shows that it wasn't a hack by Russia or by anybody else. It was a copy onto a external storage device. That's why there's this big furor going on. The press is again advancing this notion that the Russians hacked. And of course, you can't believe the Russians. And if you believe the Russians, how can anyone else be believed? All this without any tangible evidence that Russia hacked.
Bill, let's turn to you now. You've said with great confidence numerous times that the alleged hack of the DNC was actually a leak, most likely from a disgruntled insider. Now, have you ever seen any concrete proof of a hack provided by U.S. intelligence agencies?
No, I've not. And I don't nobody's ever presented evidence to me. I mean, I would be willing to look at any evidence, but no one's come up with any. So certainly nothing to look at. All I hear from them is the Russians did it, the Russians did it, the Russians did it. That's all they're saying. And expecting people to believe something without having any fundamental base for it, simply by repeating it over and over again. That's an old, sophistic technique of convincing people that something is true.
Ray, you pointed out that even the New York Times correspondent Scott Shane wrote, quote, "What is missing from the public report is what many Americans most eagerly anticipated, hard evidence to back up the agency's claims that the Russian government engineered the election attack instead." Now, the message from the agencies essentially amounts to trust us. So what does this tell us about the agenda of these intelligence agencies?
Well, actually, you have to sort of be a researcher. You have to go back at least 6 months to figure out what's going to happen. Now, Scott Shane said that on the 7th of January. On the 6th came out this magnificent memorandum prepared not by 17 intelligence agencies, not by three intelligence agencies, by hand-picked analysts from three intelligence agencies, and there was no evidence in it. So what Scott Shane is saying on the next day is, you know, what we all hoped for was some evidence that the Russians hacked, and there ain't none. And so for people to go back to that now and say, oh, but Trump is contradicting the opinion of his intelligence officers, well, he's pouring some doubt on that. Why? As any conscionable person would do, they're looking for evidence to support these charges. And I have to say that that 6 January memorandum from the FBI, NSA, and CIA was an embarrassment to any intelligence professional, particularly those engaged in nonpartisan analysis.
Bill, why is improving relations with Russia? Why does it appear that it's such a big threat to the U.S. political establishment when normalizing relations would actually be in the interest of both the American people and the Russian people?
Well, I think it's basically because they want to create another Cold War, have another continuing conflict or cold-type conflict so they can invest more trillions of dollars into the military-industrial intelligence governmental complex so that basically they can fleece us and swindle us out of more money.
Bill, let's stay with you.
I think that's the drive, yeah. I think that's what they're after.
All right, Bill, I want to stay with you. You met with CIA Director Mike Pompeo last week. I'm interested to know, how did Pompeo react to your conclusion that the available evidence does not conform to the current CIA narrative that Russia hacked the election?
Well, I think he asked what facts I had, and I basically gave him everything I could tell him about the factual evidence we did have. And about the trying, we also were trying to transfer data at a very high rate across the Atlantic. We had people here who would set up the database and had people in Europe attempt to draw the data across. We also had people try to push the data from one data center in New Jersey to a data center in the UK, and they got the maximum was roughly one-fourth of what it would be necessary to transfer the data set, just the data, not counting the housekeeping. So it really was somewhere between one-fourth and one-eighth the capacity necessary to transfer the data at the rate it was downloaded from this what's so-called DNC servers. Now, what that simply meant to us was that the network could not manage that kind of transfer, and so the download was local. And also, we pointed out that the download rate was compatible with a USB thumb drive, but it was not capable of going across the internet.
Ray, you compared the faulty intelligence used to justify the U.S. invasion of Iraq with the questionable intelligence now being used to justify aggression against Russia and even RT itself. So what is the big lesson here for the American people?
You can't trust your government is really the key. Yeah. Go ahead, Ray.
Yeah. That's what I was going to say, Bill.
I'm sorry.
No, the question really here. No. What I would say is that when you have people like John Brennan and James Clapper, who played a distinctive role in disguising the evidence that there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and then it participated in the torture and the surveillance and all this other stuff, when you have them on the mainstream media channels saying, oh, watch out, the Russians are after us again, and Clapper saying, the Russians are almost genetically determined to be really bad actors. Well, you know, that's the level of intelligence, in that sense, intelligence you have in the intelligence agencies. And unless you clean out that strata of nincompoops and also careerists, then the poor people who are trying to do an honest job in the bowels of these agencies will never see light.
Ray and Bill, I want to address this next question to you both. RT America, it's been forced to register as a foreign agent under the Foreign Agents Registration Act, or called FARA. So why do you feel RT is being singled out for the state censorship, and what does this mean for the First Amendment? Bill, you can go ahead and answer first.
Well, I think it's just a slap at the First Amendment. I mean, we here in America, we're always proud of having free speech, and meaning that we weren't going to suppress any kind of comments by anybody, even if we didn't like them. That was the whole fundamental principle of the First Amendment. Well, now this is pretty much a slap in the face. I mean, if we're going to have TV stations like RT, who are funded by the Russians, why aren't we going to force BBC or other countries, the TV stations that are funded by countries, to register also? I mean, we have no consistency in this, except we are selectively suppressing any kind of speech. And that, to me, is a direct violation of our First Amendment in the Constitution.
Ray, we have about a minute left. You can go ahead and get the final word.
Well, thanks. Now, I just cite this program here. Bill, if you say things like that, you will never be let on the what's called the mainstream media, nor will I. Do Americans deserve to hear what we have to say? Well, our combined experience in the intelligence world is something like 50 years or more. Now, one thing I'd just point out is distinctive about RT. I have to admit this, okay? And that is this, that RT has never asked me for a pre-interview interview. Now, CBS, ABC, NBC, Al Jazeera, they all say,
can we figure out what you're going to say, Mr. Kramer? Would you tell us what you're going to say? In other words, and sometimes the BBC said, oh, we don't need to get that. We have somebody else. RT has never asked me, what's your gloss on this? What would you say about this? All they do is say, here's the link, Mr. McGovern. I know you might like to come on.
While many talk about the growth of the alt-right movement under Trump, there's a much less discussed and much better organized sector of the far right that has obtained significant power.
All right, thank you both. We're going to leave it right there. That's Ray McGovern,
former
CIA analyst, and Bill Binney, NSA whistleblower.
During his campaign, Trump took care to appeal to his evangelical constituency, citing the repeal of Roe v. Wade and other key issues, signaling to his base. He received more votes from evangelical Christians than even the most overtly religious Republicans, like Mitt Romney and George W. Bush. Prominent Christian fundamentalist Mike Pence is in the empire's second highest seat of power, and the entire administration is littered with his fellow extremists, such as Betsy DeVos, Scott Pruitt, Rick Perry, Ben Carson, and Nikki Haley. Now they have unprecedented influence over U.S. policy. And the evangelical movement is just one sector of the right wing responsible for the growing threat of fascism in America. Author Chris Hedges has written extensively about what he calls the development of a Christian fascist movement. He even went undercover among them for his book, American Fascists, The Christian Right and the War on America, as well as witnessed and reported on the rise of fascism abroad. I talked to him about neo-fascism and the danger posed by this once fringe evangelical movement's recent rise to power.
Many are calling Trump a fascist, even the next Hitler. Can you define what is fascism?
Fascism is not really ideologically based. It's very protean in terms of its ideology. There's a German historian I like very much who wrote a book called Male Fantasies about the Freikorps. And he describes this was the Freikorps was the antecedents to the Nazi Party. They were demobilized right-wing World War I veterans who were used to crush the Spartacus uprising in Berlin and the kind of radical left that they killed Rosa Luxemburg and Leibniz. And it revolves more around emotion, hypermasculinity, a virulent nationalism, a celebration of quote-unquote strength, of military virtues. It holds up a kind of moral purity that it claims to represent. It's hard. Robert Paxton wrote a very good book called Anatomy of Fascism, and he notes that fascism in every country has its own peculiar characteristics in the sense that Italian fascism was very different in many ways from German fascism. I think that fascism, although I'll use the word to describe Trump, is perhaps not finally accurate. I think you're better off describing our system as what Sheldon Wolin, the political philosopher, calls inverted totalitarianism, by which he means that you're not replacing old symbols and structures. It's more like the old Roman Republic after the civil wars and the rise of Augustus. So you still had a Senate, you still supposedly had a republic, but it was all a facade. So you have corporate forces that purport to pay fealty to electoral politics, the Constitution, the iconography and language of American patriotism, but internally have seized all of the levers of power to render this citizen, disenfranchised. And Wolin writes that in that system, politics is never able to trump economics. It's all about economic consolidation, maximization of profit. And so what we're getting with Trump is, I think, a species of inverted totalitarianism with demagoguery.
Yeah, it's insane that one of Trump's first measures was basically making it harder for poor people to get mortgages.
Right, right. So what we're going to get is turbocharged neoliberalism. I mean, you can see it from all of the appointments, everybody around him.
His political base is far from monolithic. We have the Christian right, the alt-right. I know that you've spent an enormous amount of time studying the Christian right, but what exactly is the alt-right? How would you even define this ideology? Would you say it's synonymous with neo-Nazism, like how people are saying that today?
Yes, I think it has a lot of characteristics with neo-Nazism, but so does the Christian right. The Christian right, like the alt-right, is endowed with all sorts of conspiracy theories, coupled with magical thinking, coupled with an utter disdain for historical fact. And I think that what we will see is that the Christian right will become the ideology, will fill Trump's ideological vacuum, because he doesn't really have an ideology. He's such a narcissist. And I think that that will be handled through Pence. So I think this, in many ways, will be the empowerment of the Christian right, which I have always considered a political movement. I went to seminary. I grew up in the church. I do not consider them Christians any more than the German Christian church, which was pro-Nazi, was Christian. The German Christian church had the Nazi flag on one side and the Christian cross on another. That's how I look at the Christian right. And that's why you saw 81% of evangelical voters support Trump, even though his personal life makes a mockery of the very values, the kind of family values that they say they hold sacred. So I think what we're watching with the Trump presidency, especially as it comes under attack from the establishment, both the old landed Republican and Democratic establishment, you'll see his fortress become that the ideology of the Christian right, which I wrote a book called American Fascists, The Christian Right and the War in America. I didn't use that word lightly. I think they are Christianized fascists.
But certainly there's a differentiation between the Christian right and this kind of emergence of these emboldened bigots who seem to be much more vitriolic, the alt-right, who call themselves the alt-right.
No, I think the Christian right are as bigoted as the alt-right. The Christian right is much more sophisticated as a network. I mean, tens of millions of Americans are hermetically sealed within this bizarre world because they are, and with Betsy DeVos, this is going to be expanded with, if everything goes through, $20 billion of federal money, in essence, handed off to religious schools. So they are sealed within, you know, their news, their religious information, their entertainment, all gets colored with this Christian. So one of the things I learned when I wrote the book, which I spent 2 years on, was I would go to the services, and that they would have nice music, and the chairs would be a lot more comfortable than the pews in the Presbyterian church where I grew up. And it was kind of warm, and you'd feel good, and people... But then you would be pulled into the back rooms where you would be discipled and you would be assigned people. And they would really break you down and sever you from your family because next thing you know, you're there every night of the week. And I was in prayer groups where people were weeping because their children weren't saved or their husband wasn't saved. And that's one of the great ironies is they talk about family. They're the great destroyer of families. So they're quite clever in having a kind of public face, which in many ways is even appealing, but a very dark cultish. I found many aspects of cults within it in terms of the way they broke people down, the kind of inability to question these white male pastors who had direct communication with God, who made fabulous amounts of money off of these people's despair. So I think that the Christian right is a far more dangerous movement than the alt-right. And I think that it has many characteristics that it shares with the alt-right in terms of its anti-Semitism, its homophobia, its Islamophobia. I think the alt-right, because it incorporates so-called new atheists, has its own coloring. But I think it shares many common traits with the Christian right. But I don't think it's as dangerous as the Christian right. I think people focus on it because it's more visible. Mm-hmm. There is a strain of deep cruelty, savagery even, fascism, intolerance within the Christian right that is institutionalized in a way that makes it a far more dangerous movement than the alt-right.